You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Maria Corrigan is the author of The Gates of Time. Her new novel is Thistle Marsh. Thank you for joining me, Maria.
Thank you for having me.
This is a really wonderful and interesting book, and I love the beginning. I'm a big fan of Jacqueline Winspear's Maisie Dobbs novels, which are about the adventures mystery series of a nurse in England after World War One. This begins with a nurse returning from World War One. Did you know where the novel was going to go in terms of having, you know, the supernatural lore? Did you make that before, or did you just start out with the train ride and find that you, as well as the reader, were taking a train ride into a world that wasn't quite the one we grew up in?
It was definitely initially a fantasy novel. I actually, the train ride portion was one of the last things I wrote. Originally, that started in the hospital in France where her brother is. And I kind of decided I didn't really want... Mouse has lost both her cousin and her brother is severely wounded in the war. And so I wanted her to have that feeling of loss. And I wanted the readers to also have that feeling of loss. So the boys are not in the novel at all, except in flashbacks. They're not in the main text. So I decided that the train element later would be a fun way to get right into the time period and also get us moving literally through from her world that she's been living in into this like English countryside. We're kind of going back in time. But what inspired that scene was actually, it's funny you mentioned Maisie Dobbs. It was Lucy Worsley's book on Agatha Christie. And she has a portion of that book where Agatha Christie's sitting on the train and she overhears people talking about her, Agatha Christie, but they don't recognize her because she's just kind of an innocuous sort of looking person. And so, but anyway, as far as the fantasy elements, they've been there the whole time. My moment of inspiration for this novel, I saw like a crumbling manor house with a spunky heroine and a fairy kind of confronting her. And that was like my first image of the book. So fairies have always been in the time period, like in the book.
One of the things I really liked about the novel was the way you ease us in. It really is a perfect journey because the lore of England after World War One is well known. Talk about the research you had to do to just create the time period convincingly.
Yeah, I did a lot of research, particularly I did kind of more than I needed to on World War One itself. There's a really good podcast that I listen to called Not So Quiet on the Western Front, where there are these two academics and they discuss pretty much all aspects of the war from the home front to battles. So I listened to all that. I watched lots of documentaries, read lots of books on the war. And then, you know, it's after the war that the book takes place. So I felt like I kind of could experience Mouse's, or I understood Mouse's experience in a way that I wouldn't have been able to do if I hadn't done that research. So I think even though it didn't end up on page, it informed the character. So I'm happy with how I spent my time there. And then as far as the exact period, 1919 is when the book takes place. And I had part of my education over in the UK. I did my undergrad there in English Lit. But I also took classes in British history. And so I got to kind of fall back on my notes, particularly regarding the decline of the English manor house. I wrote an essay on it. And after World War One, because so many men had died in the war, there was a huge crisis because of the inheritance and people not knowing what to do next and having to pay enormous death taxes that they weren't anticipating. And by the 1950s, I believe that there was a incredibly high percentage of houses that either had to be demolished or sold on. And without the National Trust and other like organizations like that, or just like private people coming in and buying them, we wouldn't have the houses that we have today. So it's really, that period was a huge change for those classes, and especially for the actual manor houses themselves.
One of the things I really liked about the book was that the fact that the supernatural element was actually supposed to be absent from the world you had. And so I thought that was a really interesting choice that made the book really compelling to me. Talk about the supernatural stuff, which we learned fairly early on in the train journey, actually.
Yes, that's definitely true. So this world used to kind of live alongside fairies up until about the 1790s. And then we don't know why, but the fairies left, and it kind of left the humans scrambling. And so the Industrial Revolution happened and all those things happened, but it was almost a reaction to not having magic anymore and having to do things for themselves and like rapidly acquire the things that we're doing for magic, that magic was doing for them before. So what's cool, I think, is I got to, through like going to different places when I was living in the UK, I saw a lot of beautiful art and a lot of historical places, and all of them had these like gorgeous historical elements. And so one of my favorite parts of writing the book was saying, oh, okay, well, if they have a monument to Sir Walter Scott, like, why wouldn't they have a mural of all of the fairy kings that worked with alongside the kings and queens of Britain up until a point, and working in those fun, like, alternate history details, but with a magical element, were really enjoyable to me. And then creating that history of having the fairies grant, they're very powerful, so they're able to grant political power and grant, like Mouse's house, Thistlemarsh, is a fairy-blessed home, which means it used to be a fairy-owned building, so it has a lot of magical elements just sewn into it. And because it's a hall as well, that hall means something specific in terms of what a building is. And so it's like, okay, well, there used to be some kind of medieval structure. Then we went to the Tudor times. And so that's like the beautiful, think Downton Abbey, think Hardwick Hall, like beautiful windows. And then the building has continued to grow. So it has a boiler, it has all these things, but it also has that magical DNA worked in, which was so fun to do because it kind of grew up along with the history. That there's the magical history, and then there's the real history of the building.
When we first meet Thistlemarsh Hall, it is not a beautiful place. It is run down. And I think that this really, you do a great job of creating the atmosphere. And I will say that one of the things that is interesting in this book is I would say it's very cinematic. But now, often when we use the word cinematic, people describe a book as being cinematic. It's kind of like a thriller with lots of fights and car chases and whatnot. This is just, I think, a very visually oriented book. Yeah, a lot of it depends on your descriptions, which are quite good. So talk about creating this. Did you experience this book as a movie in your mind?
I think elements of it. I have very strong like images. And then you said it's cinematic, because the one thing that I really struggled with was envisioning the house. So I had to, you know, sit down and kind of draw. I literally had a floor plan blueprint of all the different floors, trying to figure it out. And then I had to scrap that because it was not working actually, like logically. And so in the end, I was like, okay, I just have to trust that I've done enough that it'll make sense on screen. But certain elements, I think, are what was really helpful is there's so many great resources that are through, there's documentaries and YouTube videos kind of exploring these old houses, I think because there's a huge interest. And so like you could walk through them virtually and like kind of just imagine all of this stuff. And I kind of stole different rooms and different places from different houses and worked them in. In that, I was envisioning certain rooms and kind of sticking them together. So I'm very happy to hear it, that you see it so like vividly. That's lovely to hear. Thank you.
A book like this really turns on its character. So talk about creating Mouse and making her, I think, more than just a spunky heroine, but, you know, a kind of a complicated girl who has unfortunate background with the shell-shocked brother and another friend of theirs dead in World War One. This is a kind of a nice tragic backdrop for the character, and it gives her some depth and complexity.
Yeah, Mouse was a really fun character to write because as the book progressed, I felt like I could kind of go into the complicated feelings of returning home, especially where, so she has all these memories of her brother and her cousin who were very close to her, and she loved them. And that was where she had all her memories with them, is at Thistlemarsh. But at the same time, she's an unwanted child. She's not illegitimate, but she's pretty much as close as you can be in this time period without being. And then she's also a girl, and her uncle, who owns the property, dislikes her. Because I think that she reminds him of his sister who, you know, was disgraced and married the gardener and kind of had her own adventure that we don't see, but is the impetus of the book. But what I found is as I wrote Mouse more, I was kind of shying away from, I was like, oh man, it's hard to have her have such complex emotions about the house because, you know, she loves it, but it's a complicated place for her to be. And she has so many bad memories and so many good memories. And at the same time, I was living back at home during COVID. And so I was in like a similar space. I love my house. I love my family. We were all together, but it was kind of a complicated feeling to be in the place I grew up. And then later on, I actually still live there. I rent from my parents who moved out. So changing the house to suit my needs and my husband's needs compared to what it was when I was a child, you know, there's a feeling of, oh man, I don't want to change this, even though I kind of don't like it and I want to make my own way. And so I think as I was experiencing that, I could kind of understand the character more. And I was like, okay, this is good that she's complex. I just need to make it clear that her feelings are complex and not inconsistent. And that was a difficult thing to do, but hopefully it comes through in the writing. And I think that she's a stronger character for it.
When she arrives, she finds out, unsurprisingly to her, you know, because she was unliked and unwanted in the house originally, that there's a big complication in her inheritance. Talk about the man Carlyle, who's, you know, a reprehensible fellow at best, and back at his representative, and the deal that she has to make, that she's forced to accept, in if she has any hope of getting the house, which is what she finds is wrecked, abandoned, and, you know, left to weather in the elements. One can well imagine what such a house would look like. And you do a great job of describing it as well.
Thank you. So Carlyle is kind of the, like, the worst of British aristocracy, like, in one character. So he's very self-motivated. He's cruel. He's, you know, he's very, he's xenophobic, homophobic, all those things wrapped up in one person. And he... it's just kind of an oily person. When I was describing him, I feel like I worked in a lot of descriptions of grease and oil and that kind of thing where, you know, he's clearly a very unhappy person, but he takes it out on everyone else, which is a bummer. But pretty much Mouse is given the choice of she has to fix up Thistlemarsh Hall within the month as a stipulation of kind of the fairy rules that are related to the inheritance, or it will go to Carlyle. And Carlyle sort of had a hand in, I don't want to spoil too much, but kind of just trying to disgrace her brother and her cousin. And so she doesn't like him just on a personal level, but there's also background and kind of he's her worst enemy. So she really doesn't want him to inherit. And he's distantly related to the family. He's like the next in line. He's the Mr. Collins of my book, and that he's a distant relation who stands to inherit. And we don't see much of him. I think that's a good thing because he's a very strong flavor and you don't want too much of it in any place. He's a reprehensible person, as you said. And I think that having him as a representation of the aristocracy that was uncomplicated kind of worked well with her relationship with her uncle, and also her relationship with later on. There's kind of fairy aristocrats that she has to deal with, and they have a more complicated relationship. But Mouse, as you know, the daughter of a gardener, and he has these classist elements to him, Carlyle, and so they can have an uncomplicated antagonistic relationship, and everybody's on Mouse's side because Carlyle's just nasty as a person.
The deal for her is that she has exactly 1 month to fix the house up to the specs of this fellow Beckett, who's, you know, Carlyle's kind of right hand, although not as reprehensible as Carlyle. It's quite clear early on that this is going to be an impossible task for her. And I think one of the things I love about this book is that you do a good job of, like, suggesting. And so the reader kind of knows that things are happening that the character doesn't. So you keep up a pretty high state of tension, because we're always maybe like 1.5 steps ahead of Mouse, and then she's ahead of us, and then we're ahead of her. Talk about designing the plot so that what the reader knows and what the character knows and what the reader can guess, given both the genre and what's going on in the book, you know, that keeps up a kind of constant tension in the book. I found it kind of a page turner, which was a bit of a surprise, to be honest.
Well, thank you. As far as like trying to contain what the character knows versus what the audience knows, I think a lot of it is like, Mouse is a smart person who has been educated in the way of the fairies, but at the same time, you know, things have to happen in the book and she has to make the deal with the fairy. Otherwise the book doesn't happen. So she needs to like be in a position where she is desperate enough to kind of go against what she knows, because she knows deals with fairies don't work out. She has a history of all this. She wanted to be a fairy anthropologist before the war. And then it, you know, the war happened and she had to be a nurse, but, she has that knowledge, and it's kind of playing with what she knows, what she's willing to compromise on, and then kind of establishing things for the reader. So it's like, okay, like I've given you this hint that this is something that is a fairy trait. Will you pick up on it? Will Mouse pick up on it? And then will it pay off later? So there are like quite a few things going on in the novel with that, like to varying levels of like importance. So some it's kind of like, oh, you know, like it's okay, Mouse missed that. And then later on it's like, oh no, that was like important. She missed it, but she's desperate. And so hopefully we're willing to forgive her for missing it, because we know that she knows, but she's forgotten it in the moment or overlooked it, or it's something sort of beyond her control that's kind of moving around her shoulder. And so she hasn't clocked it yet. And also it helps that everyone is actively trying to trick her. I mean, we have her allies, like Thornwood, the fairy lord she makes the deal with, is an ally, but he's also a fairy. And so we understand from the narrative that fairies will try to trick you. It's part of their, like, it's their business to trick people and try to get the most out of the deals. And so we have to have that, like, feeling of, okay, is he trustworthy? But there's elements of, like, they're growing closer and they're working together and they have similar, like, trauma in their lives. And so are we willing to like be like, oh, he's trustworthy now? And that's sort of the way with a lot of characters in the book. And then at the same time, the people that she knew before that she trusted, they're like, oh, Mouse, you're making decisions that are not very smart. And she's like, I know, but I'm desperate. What do you want from me? and so I think working those things and having the audience have these breadcrumbs throughout of little details they could pick up on and figure it out beforehand. Like, I love reading mysteries. I'm not very good at solving them before the detective does. I usually find out when the whole cast is finding out, but I love reading them. And so I try to take those elements and work them in as much as I could.
You know, you just mentioned mystery. Yeah, that's a great take, because there is a certain amount of mystery going on here, especially with Thornwood. He's the fairy lord who comes into our life. I won't say how, because I think that's really well handled in the novel. But as she talks with him and deals with him, all the time, you know, in our head, we're thinking that, you know, fairies are really the ultimate unreliable narrators. Anything they say is suspect and meant to deceive in some ways, and it's not always their intention to deceive, maybe, but it's their nature. So talk about, it must be really fun to have, you know, one of your main characters be a completely unreliable but somewhat likable character. And I think that you handled the relationship between the two really well. And it wasn't just a lot. You eschewed swooning. Thank you very much.
Thank you. well, I would say that an interesting part about fairies is that even though they're constantly trying to trick you, they have the stipulation that they can't lie. And so when they're trying to trick you, they have to tell the truth, but they can tell it in a strange way or obfuscate the question or, you know, do something to distract you. And what I experienced was I tried so hard. I went through the manuscript several times. I was like, no one's lying. This is great. But still, my copy editor was like, ah, he's lying there. He's lying there. And I was like, no. Oh, no, I need to find a more subtle way to make it so that he's, you know, Mouses, again, it's hard to have a character who you want the people to be like, okay, yeah, she's working with what she has and not making silly decisions. And so she, being someone that I think is intelligent, she has to be convinced by him and his like tricks. And so he was a really fun character to write and a challenging character to write, because it would be like, okay, well, how can he trick her when she's clever and he's can't lie? And so that was an element that was very fun to work with. And I think as far as what you said, that they're not necessarily, it's in their culture, in their DNA to be tricksy. And they kind of work on a moral, we're not on this, humans and fairies are not on the same moral like code. And so in a way, Mouse is like, when she's dealing with fairies, she's like, this is how they are. It's not like, it's not personal. So that also kind of helps too. And it's interesting to deal with. Like you said, it's dealing with someone who's completely unreliable, but you want to like them because they're quite charming and fun to be around, and exciting. They're exciting to be around because they're magical and unpredictable. And Mouse is kind of a practical, down-to-earth person who wants things to be predictable. And so having Thornwood in there to be unpredictable is, I think, a good contrast to her character.
Now, there's a big part of this book, which is a very popular genre on video these days, house renovations.
Yes.
But you have a lot of fun with this because it's magical house renovations. And not only is Thornwood able to summon some level of magic to make this all much easier, he also has to battle the magic that's built into the house, which I thought was a nice touch. So talk about, you know, your design for his magic versus that which is left over in the house. And I think the magic itself is well handled. I used to work for a company whose motto was, an Arthur C. Clarke quote, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
I love that quote. I So as far as the magical house renovation, I am not a house renovator, but I have seen many house renovation videos. And so as he was doing things, I was like, okay, so I want it to be a fairy element. And so the bargains that fairies make with humans are necessary for them to do their magic. So I might be misquoting myself here, but he tells Mouse, rearranging a bookshelf might cost you a fingernail, whereas killing someone will cost you your heart. So there's like an equal payment on either side. And so she needs the house to be renovated. And so she gives something of hers that then charges his magic. And his is quite a earthy sort of magic, which I think is folk. I like to have as far as a folkloric element, because these fairies are ancient, they're more of a feudal world. And so having those like vines grow into the house, and like his magic being green and like powerful in that way, and through her, and her father was a gardener. So I'm trying to link those ideas as best as I could. And then as far as the house magic, it has that lore. So it's like it's a fairy blessed house, which means initially there was some kind of magic there. And then over the years, we don't know exactly what's happened in the book, in the beginning, no spoilers, but there are different layers of magic that have been put in place to defend against fairy intruders and also just anybody who tries to like attack the house. And so although the house is falling apart, it sees Thornwood trying to do his magic as an intrusion against the stones themselves. So it starts fighting back against him. And then, he thinks this will all be done in a couple of days, and like, oh great, this will be a really easy thing for me to do. But it turns out no, it takes a lot longer because the house is fighting back against him, and kind of has its own character and its own, different rooms have different like vibes that are magical vibes, and so he has to do different. They both have to work together to untangle these roots in the house.
This, what you just said, the house has its own character. This is, regularly done where somebody will say, well, the city of blank is a character in this book. And in this case, it's, the English estate, a house, the rotting English estate house is a character in this book. So talk about, you've spoken a bit about that, but I think, your interior descriptions, your exterior descriptions, the garden, that all works really well. I can actually really see that in my mind. I can go there and visit it. And that's the hallmark for me of a good book. It's like reading this book is like Rick's vacation in a rotting English manor. I can go back and visit my memory. And if I went to, to a degree, I'm glad I didn't have to go to a rotting English manor to experience it. I can, it's easier in your book.
Well, thank you. I mean, so I feel the same way about a lot of like, I grew up on period dramas, so it's like, oh, in my mind, I can visit Downton Abbey in my head, or like visit. A big influence on this book was Rebecca, so Manderley, which this beginning of Rebecca starts with, oh, last night I dreamed I was at Manderley again, and it was like rotting, and I'm like, ah, yes, like I can envision that, and so I'm glad that that's sort of captured in the book. And I think in these, it's kind of a genre thing where the house itself is a character. I mean, like you said, a lot of things. It's like, oh, the city of Vancouver is a character in the book, but I think that in historical novels or historical romances, a lot of the time there is this like Pemberley or Manderley or Thornfield Hall in Jane Eyre. They have this. I think it's because it's like the character's home, and so you feel like an attachment to it through them, and it's where they feel the most comfortable. Except in the case of Rebecca, which obviously she's not very comfortable there. So, but it's a presence, and I think that a lot of the times it's something that is a draw about those books. I noticed kind of an increase in those books coming out around like 2020, 21, where you had books like Alex Harrow's Starling House, which is another story about a house that has this character, and like also Haslam Castle. Like that's a very popular book at the moment. And I think people are looking for a place that they can go in their mind that's beautiful, but also like complicated and a little dark and a little exciting. And so luckily, I think Thistle Marsh works in that way. And I partially designed it in that way. So I hope it works in that way. And then the gardens, oh my goodness, I spent so much time in the gardens and learning about gardening because I'm not a gardener, but my grandmother is. And so little of that description ended up in the book. I was telling someone recently, I was like, oh, I spent hours designing this garden and it's only in two scenes, but I hope it comes through. But yeah, so I want it to be like a place people can envision going. So I'm glad that that has come across.
There are lots of really interesting what one might call set pieces in the novel. And I'm wondering if the set pieces happened to you before you put them in the plot? Or do you think, oh, wow, this, it would be great if this thing could happen? One of them has to do with a rug. And there's a couple of one of them has to do with a hunt. And so talk about it. Did you decide, did the set pieces precede the novel? Or were they like just waiting in your brain to rain down? Oh, this is, now is the time for this to happen.
I think it was more the latter, just because it's like they're kind of essentials of a British estate. So there's like a pond, and I'm like, oh, wow, that would be a fun place for something magical to happen, you know, with a big Grecian fountain in it or something. And then like there, like you said, there's a tapestry depicting a hunt, and they're in so many, you see them at any estate that you go to that has like a medieval portion of it has like a beautiful tapestry. And I was thinking, oh my goodness, of course the estate has a tapestry in it. And then it kind of led into, oh, this is a perfect place for this magic thing to happen. So it's almost like those objects were scattered across the estate. And then as I was writing, I was like, oh, this is the perfect thing to incite the magical element of the story.
You mentioned a genre once, and this novel, in the end, I think, you know, it at least partially partakes of a genre that typically, when I see it mentioned as a sales point, which it wasn't mentioned in this novel, thank you people for that, that you know, I look at and think, okay, check that book, it's probably not going to be a brick book, and that's romanticy. Which is, you know, a fantasy romance, and you know, I was never a fan of Cinderella. You know,
fair. I understand. I mean, I think that the appeal of romanticy, it's not used to market my book, and I think that that's partially because there's a growth in cozy fantasy, which is kind of how people have been marketing my book. I wasn't necessarily thinking about genre when I was writing it, which I think is why it's so cross-genre. There's historical elements, romance elements, and fantasy elements. But as far as, like, I've read a lot of books recently that have been called romanticy, and I think you're right. It is totally like a marketing thing. But for mine, I don't have very much. It's low on the spice scale as far as how it's described. So there's some kissing. There's a little bit more than that, but it's pretty tame compared to what might usually be called romanticy.
Thank you very much.
I think that I understand. I mean, and I don't. I enjoy. I'm happy for the people who love romanticy. I think it's good to get people reading. And I also. Yeah. And what I really have enjoyed is meeting other people in the now cozy fantasy space, which a lot of it's a growing trend. I don't think it'll ever be as big as romanticy or anything like that. But what's nice is that we're all kind of in the same situation where we're like, oh, OK, this is like a cross genre moment. So a lot of it is, you know, people opening a cafe, but they're an orc and they used to fight in a war and now they're trying to recover. A lot of it's to do with like healing and mending. And there's different levels of like darkness. I think there you can go really, really sweet with cozy. And then you can also be like, you know, have World War I in it. And that's still in the same branch. And I really like that. It's fun to meet this kind of like diverse group of people all writing in this space, but we all have a common interest. And I think Romanticy has been good for the fantasy community, but I know it can also really put off certain people who are like, oh, I don't want to read the spice, or, oh, I'm more interested in the fantasy than I am the romance, which usually for Romanticy, the romance comes first and the fantasy comes second, which my book, it's more fantasy and history and then the romance, which, you know, I think that that's a real, it tells people what's on the tin, which I think is good.
Well, I'm a veteran of the splatterpunk versus quiet horror genre interface of the 1980s. So, and I enjoy both genres and stuff that was completely outside. But it's interesting to see the marketing hand reach in, which I think is one of the reasons that I liked your book. I didn't sense it. I just sensed, you know, idea of fairies, and I thought that was really well handled, because one of the things I like about fairies is that they're not just charming and handsome. There's a whole darkness, and almost, you know, if you look at the way Machen created them, they were, you know, almost Lovecraftian in their nature. There was a whole, you know, universe of darkness behind them that we couldn't understand. Now, one of the things about your book that I think is really nice is the way that it you lay this set this whole thing up for her to inherit the house, and things, you know, can just when you think things have to go right because of the magic, they go wrong. And but I think that this is one of the powers of the using the fantastic in a book. Talk about using the, you know, the supernatural and the fairy powers and magic itself as a way of externalizing the aspects of your characters that are otherwise difficult to talk about, so that you can, if somebody's got a really bad, you know, problem in their past, they can either sit around and, you know, say to be or not to be, which is dramatic maybe, but not as exciting to read. Whereas if they have something dark in their past and that dark is represented by something outside of them, then all of a sudden their inner conflict becomes a plot point. And that's a lot more exciting. I think you do a good job of using the fantastic to create plot points that, you know, excavate where your characters are coming from.
Oh, thank you. I think that what I kind of have a background in is musical theater and opera. And in musical theater, kind of along the same lines, they say really what makes a good musical is that when the song hits, it's meant to be a reflection of something that no one can say, they can only sing it. And I think that magic is also the same way. So it's like it's an interiority of them that cannot be contained within their body. And so this magic is, it's an extension of them, and it kind of reflects their, I don't want to say like, it's not necessarily their soul, but it's something intrinsic about them. And I mean, obviously the fairies can do magic. So the different fairies that we might encounter in the story do different kinds of magic. And you can see that in the way the magic manifests and the way that they manifest. And Thornwood has a servant named Micklewaith, and he is a human who can do magic. And his magic works differently and is a little stickier and a little darker. And that's sort of because of how he came about it. And so it reflects kind of his trauma, I would say, in how he ended up getting there. And we don't touch too much on it in the book, but I hope that just the idea of that is expressed through the magic itself. And I think magic really only works when it's, you don't want magic to just exist in the world. You want it to do something within the plot, or to do something that is impossible but has a cost. And I think that magic having a cost is another side of that, where it's a reflection. So it's like you might sell your pinky for a renovation project. And then you also have to live with the fact that that's what you've done. It might change your life. So that's kind of the way that magic works within the novel. And I think it is a reflection of them and their different characters.
Well, from what I've seen in the modern renovation genre, renovation costs a whole lot more than a pinky.
Exactly. This is a great deal.
Yeah, she got a great deal. things I think that for me was so interesting was too, you know, the historical memory of the fairies and how, you know, the supernatural, the idea that supernatural events happened in the past, now they've kind of been forgotten or put away or overrun slightly by modernity. That's the basis of almost all religions. And so talk about, you know, the presence of fairies or the one-time presence of fairies and their remnants as a kind of, you know, look at religion. We're you know, always looking for some evidence of the supernatural, some evidence that, you know, when we pass that there's something more than riding underground or you know, having your ashes scattered.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that so we have Mouse, and her best friend is a Anglican priest, and so he has his own like interpretation of fairies that coincides sort of with his religion. So there's that element within the book, and then Mouse is sort of established as an atheist, and it's this discussion of you want. Here, let me think about this for a second. One moment. As far as the history of the fairies in the world, I think that it works. When I was writing it, there's this difference between the continental fairies and the fairies in Britain. And it's because the continental fairies are still kind of held up almost like saints, whereas the fairies in England are almost more secular because England changed during the reign of Henry VIII and like the dissolution of the monasteries and all those things. And so those fairies, they work in a different way than they'd work on the continent. And this is very lightly touched on in the book, but it's not a main plot point. But they are a little bit more secular than they would be on the continent. But they still hold this place in the society of being the fixers of all things that have then kind of abandoned England to their own devices. And religion exists within the story. You know, there is an Anglican priest, there is the Catholic Church, those things still exist. But there's also this kind of evidence of the magical, which you'd think would be in conflict with those things. But because of the actual existence of fairies, they were taken on by the church as their own. You can't really deny it when fairies are doing magic and like gifting people houses. It's a little different than, you know, the stories that are in our world. And so they've been co-opted into a magical way. But the fairies don't have a moral code, as we discussed earlier. So they're not like benevolent, godlike creatures in that way. They're more neutral. And so I think that having the existence of those things in this world sort of changes a religious aspect in that world, where it's like, okay, we have a neutral, powerful force that used to exist and used to be here and is now gone. What do we do with that? And I hope I touch on it a little bit in the book, but I do have some religious themes as well, you know, and that we can kind of get along on that level too, that Mouse is an atheist, but her best friend's an Anglican priest and they can work together and he can still have his beliefs and she can have her sort of lack of belief and they can both exist.
This book firmly fits into the Gothic genre. You have a woman in a big old house with that mayor that is definitely haunted.
True,
and,
true.
And you wear your gothic heart on your sleeve, because we hear early on she hands Jane Eyre to Thornwood, and is early on she's rereading herself. So talk about, you know, how much of the gothic genre did you read as a kid or growing up? Or, you know, were you a big Jane Eyre fan? Or where did you come from in that regard?
Yeah, so I am, what I'll say is I'm actually more of an Austen fan. I love Charlotte Bronte particularly. I'm not a fan of Wuthering Heights, not because of the recent version, but because I think it's a little dark, Wuthering Heights. Not that Jane Eyre is not, but I started with Pride and Prejudice, and from there, I was very young. I joined the Jane Austen Society when I was 8 years old, and have been a member for since, and I'm 30. So, you know, it's been a long experience. And I've read, you know, when you're a Jane Austen nerd, you end up reading a lot around that. So, you know, if you read Northanger Abbey, then you're like, oh, maybe I should read The Mysteries of Udolpho. And then you read that and Frankenstein. And my undergrad was in English literature. And so I took the Romantics course. I read all of the, you know, Percy Shelley, Byron, I read all those poems. So there were a big influence in that way. And I was lucky because the University of Edinburgh had a really good horror course where we read loads and loads of horror that sort of, it doesn't bleed into Thistlemarsh, but there is a touch of that gothic. And I think you can't get to horror and mystery without having that stepping stone of gothic literature that, you know, was around in the late 1700s, early 1800s, up until Rebecca and Alfred Hitchcock. So all of those things are huge interests of mine, and I love them. And right now I'm rereading Jane Eyre as a treat, as the book is about to come out. And I just recently watched Rebecca to also have a treat. So yeah, definitely you caught me. I am a gothic lit fan, and I always will be. so this was sort of my love letter to that.
Books of arcane books of knowledge always play a part. I mean, the Necronomicon from H.P. Lovecraft has appeared in more books than he ever, more words almost than he ever reported. It works. You have your own version of that. It's Lady Blakeney's stories. And you actually write some fairy tales in here, which seem to be like nicely, they are very nicely a sidestep from real fairy tales. So talk about, you know, the importance. You know, on one hand, we have fairy lords, which is one kind of look at the fairy world, and fairy tales, which is a very different kind of look. Both of them partake of the supernatural, but one is the fairy lords are a little darker, more complex, but no, not more complex, a different kind of complexity than the fairy tales, where things are a little bit more out in the open. You can kind of see the stitching of how things are going to fall. So talk about creating those fairy tales, which are delightful to read.
Thank you. Like you said, they are quite a sidestep from real fairy tales. So I was really inspired by, you know, Brothers Grimm and Perrault, but mostly the ones collecting in the 1800s. So like Bjornson and Moe, and then Lady Wilde, Oscar Wilde's mother, and having those stories. But at the same time, these are real creatures who exist in the world. So they're collecting the stories, and they're folk tales, but the creatures do exist. It's not like a witch in a Brothers Grimm story. And so they also have an element of a travel log about them, because she's interacting with this, sorry, Lady Blakeney, who's the collector of the stories, is interacting with this fairy, how she's getting her stories from him and traveling around with him and collecting them. And so researching it was very fun, because I got to research fairy tales, which I grew up loving. And at the same time, I got to read these sort of in period travelogue. So there's this one called The Fairy Faith in Celtic Countries, and it was written by this American man who went to Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and I think the Isle of Man to collect stories from around there from the local people. And the book is super antiquated and very, very silly in a lot of ways, but it's also a really fun read because it's him traveling and having this happen and then him writing down the stories from the source. So that was an inspiration, as well as the actual Grimm stories, which I just kind of adapted to have the moral themes and behaviors of the fairy that exist in the Thistlemarsh world.
I'm wondering, have you started the second book yet?
I can't say anything really definitive, but I am working on some projects in the same world, and maybe sometime soon I'll be able to talk about it more. But ideally, I'd like to touch on some different eras in the history, but within the same world and dealing with the same fairy human connection.
Earlier, I talked about this being cinematic. Has this been optioned, or are you out there trying to put it out? Because I can see this being an ideal BritBox series right down on Amazon.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I think that my team is, you know, doing all the stuff that they can do. I've been very lucky so far. I've gotten a lot of translations, so it's coming out in Czech, in Spanish, in Italian, and Brazil, which I initially sort of surprised me with Brazilian Portuguese. But as a member of the Jane Austen Society, as already established, they have a huge Brazilian membership. So I was, of course, the fantasy period drama would be popular in Brazil. That's so exciting. So yes, I understand that things are, you know, are working. As far as options go, you know, it's always up in the air, but I've been incredibly lucky so far, and I appreciate you saying that it makes me feel nice to know that it could be imagined as a BritBox period drama.
The new book by Moira Corrigan is Thistlemarsh. Thank you for joining me, Moira.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.